Hello. This is Michael Brennan Doherty from the American Conservative, and I think, Robert, you should introduce yourself to the blogging heads watchers out there.
Hi, well, this is Robert Jones. I'm the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. And we're here because the Public Religion Research Institute just put out a report today. It's titled Committed to Availability, Conflicted About Morality, What the Millennial Generation Tells Us About the Future of the Abortion Debate and the Culture Wars. So I think the first thing to do is just tell us a little bit about this study, maybe the few big takeaways from
it. Well, this has been a really fascinating study to work on. It's one of the largest studies ever conducted on abortion and religion. It was funded by the Ford Foundation. It's a 3,000-person telephone survey of all Americans. But because it's so big, we were actually able to focus in on looking at the millennials. And just a quick note about, you know, why we did it. And I think one of the reasons why is that there's been, you know, various assertions about where the younger generation, the millennial generation, and by that generation I mean those born typically after 1980 and who were kind of coming of age around the year 2000, the millennium. But been various assertions about where this group is on abortion, and then also where they are on kind of issues that are usually talked about in conjunction with this, such as same-sex marriage. So one of the things we wanted to do was to really focus in on millennials and try to figure out exactly where they were on the issue of abortion. But we also wanted to ask, get a good look at where at the religious landscape in America to figure out where how religion impacted this issue of abortion among the general population as well. So we're kind of up to two things, kind of religion and millennials are the focus of the survey on the issue of abortion.
Right. And I think the thing people are going to – one of the headlines people are going to take out of this, are taking out of this right now, is that though millennials are very different from their from older generations or preceding generations in their opinions on gay marriage, they are much more pro gay marriage than preceding generations. And though they're less religious than preceding generations, they are not significantly more pro-choice. And a lot of people, of course, twin those issues together. And the millennials seem to be at least breaking them apart, at least in the way that they measure against the rest of the country.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that we really document well in this survey is what we're calling the kind of decoupling of the issues of same-sex marriage and abortion, and this really being driven by this younger generation. So, as you mentioned, they're a good 20 points more supportive of allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry than the general population and than their parents are. But on the issue of abortion, if you're really talking about a measure of legality, they really do look like their parents. They look no different than the general population and about like their parents do on the issue of abortion. So clearly they're approaching these issues, you know, in really different ways.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, I guess, speculate that, well, there's no victim in, or there's no potential victim in a gay marriage, right? Or any victim that's posed is extremely diffuse and abstract. But pro-lifers can make an argument that there's a victim in an abortion. So, you know, people's associations with the two are very different. And it's interesting, the study showed that pretty clearly, I think, in a part where it talks about top-of-mind associations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so when it talks about when you talk to millennials and you ask them to think of words that they associate with gay marriage and abortion, there are many more negative words associated mm-hmm. that they associate with abortion than they do with gay marriage. And in the gay marriage ones tend to be not only positive, but the positive words tend to be extremely positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the study said, people would say, write down, go for it, or awesome.
Right, it's cool. Yeah, those kinds of things, right.
And even the negative words, even the negative top-of-mind associations were expressed with an almost ambivalence,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, not my thing.
Right.
Whereas on abortion, the words were... the negative words were extremely, maybe not as extremely negative, but they'd say disgusting or irresponsible.
Sad, right, scary, sad,
bad,
yeah.
Death. And it was just, I found that very, very interesting. I mean, is there anything more to that? I mean, is there anything more than that kind of surface analysis that there's potentially a victim? Is there something about the religion or...
No, you're right to point to this, and I should just clarify what that, you know, when we would say top-of-mind association, really what that was, that came from a set of focus groups that we conducted among white, politically moderate 18 to 29-year-olds in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we sort of did a series of focus groups there. And one of the things we did was we just asked them to write down on an index card, you know, at the very beginning of the session, we hadn't talked about anything, we hadn't prompted them with anything at all, and we said, you know, we wanted to just sort of give us your first impressions of two words, and one was abortion and one was same-sex marriage. And the terms you've been describing were what we got. And these were kind of emotional, you know, responses without a lot of thought. They were just the first thing that popped into their mind. What's interesting about that is that, and this maybe goes to a thing we could talk about, you know, we didn't ask anything about whether there's a potential victim, but what we did ask about is whether is people's moral evaluation. So we had kind of on the one hand, we had these kind of top-of-mind associations. And basically what we came, what we found there was, you know, about 53-54% had negative associations with abortion, and about the same number had positive associations with the issue of same-sex marriage that we're talking about. But we also asked them about moral evaluations of these two issues. You know, and more than 6 in 10 millennials actually say that, you know, sex between, or right at 6 in 10, say sex between adults of the same gender is a morally acceptable thing, right? And that's very different than older generations. But when you look at a moral evaluation of abortion, again, millennials actually look right at where their parents are. They're basically divided on the issue of whether having an abortion is a moral thing to do or not. So very different moral evaluations as well as kind of emotional kind of reactions. Now, what I think is interesting about that is that you've got, you know, very conflicted emotions, very conflicted moral evaluations, and yet when you ask millennials about whether whether abortion should be legal in all or most cases, you get 6 in 10 saying yes, it should be legal in all or most cases, and you have 68%, nearly 7 in 10, saying that it should be available in their local community. So there's clearly a very complex set of tensions going on here that the millennial generation is navigating, you know, in ways fairly similar to their parents are.
Yeah, it was interesting too. You know, there were questions, I think, about maybe I'm confusing one part of the study with another, but there were questions about whether an abortion is a sin and whether it is the most responsible thing to do. And actually, one of the really mysterious findings, I think, was that there were a number of respondents who would say that, yes, abortion is a sin, but yes, it's also, in some circumstances, the most responsible thing to do.
Right, right.
I mean, what do you make of that as someone doing this kind of work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things we tried to do in this survey is really get beyond, you know, some of the kind of knee-jerk, do you think it's legal or not legal, and really try to get underneath to get a sense of, you know, how people are – this is an issue that people struggle with, I think. And, you know, if you really pay attention to even some of these basic benchmark measures, you know, you have, you know, very few Americans really staking out – the polls on these issues. You have, you know, many more Americans somewhere in the middle, you know, whether they lean toward legality or they lean toward illegality. They're somewhere in the middle, and it's because of these kind of moral complexities on this issue that they're there, and we see this kind of wiggle in the middle. So, you know, what's interesting is, generally speaking, on the issue of sinfulness, we have, you know, in the general population, we have, a majority saying that abortion is not – having an abortion is not morally acceptable. But we have slightly less than that willing to say that it's a sin. And yet, as you point out, we have legality, strong support, you know, 56% support for legality, 58% support for being available in your local community. And I think part of what's going on here – and we actually did some trend analysis using some Gallup data to see – whether this moral complexity had really been there. And, you know, we could go back at least 10 years in the Gallup data, and we see this gap between morality and legality with morality being about kind of people saying that that having an abortion is a moral thing to do, being about 10 points lower than the same survey saying that it should be legal. And I think that, you know, this is just where the American public is. This kind of goes to the title, the score we came from, the title of the report, you know, conflicted about morality, but really kind of committed to legality and availability. And, you know, that's it's what we've been actually calling this a stable tension in the American public, because it's been there for so long. It's not like one of these are, you know, the legality side's not finally resolving the moral conflicts, and the moral concerns are not finally pulling support for legality. These things have been very, very stable for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of available, we talk about wiggle room, there's obviously a lot of potentially coherent views in that 10% gap between morality and legality,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you could believe that it's a sin and that it's immoral and that it still should be legal. I mean, there's lots
right.
of conservative Christians who think all sorts of things are sinful but should be legal. You know, so that it's interesting, though, that you know, legality doesn't speak to whether, you know, you could believe that maybe abortion should be legal, but that's immoral, and that government should, you know, encourage people to not have abortions,
mm-hmm.
you know, through certain education programs or social funding or whatever. It was also interesting, focusing on this ongoing tension, the study did a few little measures of how certain things in the culture might affect someone's opinion on
mm-hmm.
whether abortion should be
yeah.
legal or not. And why don't you describe some of those things,
yeah.
and then we'll get into that.
Yeah, so, you know, at the end of the report, we tried to break some new ground. I mean, some of the commentators said today at our event at Brookings, you know, this is an area that's been a lot of polling has been done on. And so we know some things already from, you know, previous studies that we've done and others have done that are pretty powerful predictors of people's, you know, independent predictors of people's views on the issue of abortion. So I'll mention a couple of those, but then I'll just for context, and I'll talk about the new ones. But, you know, what we know is that two of the most powerful predictors are religious factors. That is, whether one
mm-hmm.
attends religious services, how frequently one attends religious services, and whether one has a more literal view of the Bible or not, and then whether one is affiliated with being an evangelical Christian. Those three things are pretty powerful predictors in themselves. And then, of course, there's other things like party affiliation,
mm-hmm.
and ideology, education levels. All of those things are certainly important and pretty powerful. But we also did want to kind of think about some cultural factors, many of which we've kind of heard about in the public, and see which one of these actually had some relevance. I'll just talk about two of them that I think are the kind of most interesting, and they are a finding that watching MTV's shows, reality shows, Teen Mom and 16 and Pregnant, these shows specifically turned out to be a significant predictor of one having a more supportive view of the legality of abortion. So holding all other things constant about a person,
right.
if a person watches these shows, they're more likely to support the legality of abortion than not. And on the other side, one that we tested was having recently seen an ultrasound image of a fetus, and found similarly that holding all other factors equal, having recently seen an ultrasound image of a fetus makes one less likely to support the legality of abortion. And there were a few more that we tested as well, but those are two I think that are, you know, pretty interesting. On the MTV front, what's interesting about that is that we actually didn't prompt people on that question. We just asked people, have you seen any movies or television shows that talk about unmarried teenagers who have an unintended pregnancy, and yes or no? And if they said yes, we asked an open-ended question that allowed them to write in any, you know, to sort of tell the interviewer any show that they had. And it turns out that these two shows, Teen Mom and 16 and Pregnant, overwhelmingly were the shows that everybody talked about and were watched by a very high percentage of millennials. And incidentally, maybe not surprisingly, given they're on the MTV, not seen by hardly any American 65 years of age or older.
Right. You know, is there any, were there any controls? Because, you know, someone might say, well, you know, a more liberal family might allow their son or daughter to watch more MTV.
Right.
Than a more conservative one, and then also someone who might be involved in a pro-life movement or heavily involved in church, and church groups often have seminars where you might, about abortion, where you might see an ultrasound image, that there's, you know, there's a little bit of affiliation there, mm-hmm. kind of, that seems to be already baked in.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right, and that's why it's really important to, I mean, it's a great question to ask, and, you know, what we did in the is that we actually had a regression model that controlled for a number of things. You know, we obviously can't control for everything, but we tried to control for the
right.
things that were obvious that might be, you know, kind of, as you point out, an alternative explanation for why this person might. So basically what we controlled for in the models were frequency of religious attendance, views on biblical literalism, race, religious affiliation, uh-huh. party affiliation, ideology, whether one's liberal or not, education, age, and ethnicity, so whether one's Hispanic or identifies as Hispanic. So with that set of controls, holding all those things equal, these things still showed up as independent predictors.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. I mean, I almost laughed when I encountered this in the study, too, though, because just anecdotally, I had been in Brooklyn recently, and it was a Friday night. I was meeting with, you know, other people that write or in journalism.
Uh-huh.
And I was just trying to enjoy a drink, and somehow I was getting dragooned into an argument about the morality of abortion. And the first thing the person brought up was MTV's 16 and Pregnant.
Oh, uh-huh.
It was unbelievably potent symbol for her. I mean, and it was all about empathy and these emotional reactions. Like, you know, she would explain to me, you know, have you seen these girls? Their lives are just totally ruined. They have all these dreams and they have to change, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's a really, it's interesting too, because the show, at least as I can't claim to be a fanatic about it or have seen it a lot, but the show seems to show, you know, teen mothers struggling, but in some senses triumphing and navigating through a lot of difficulty.
Yeah.
And, but still the thought is just so, so powerful. That I mean, I'm not surprised that it drives a lot
mm-hmm.
Of the opinion on this.
Yeah. Well, it was something that we actually heard in our focus groups, and you know, I'll have to admit, not being a millennial myself, like I hadn't even heard of the show before we did the focus groups. But it was
right.
But you know, as soon as somebody brought it up, like, you know, somebody brought it up unprompted in the focus groups, and every head in the room started nodding. When it came up in the focus
yeah.
groups, we're like, okay, we've definitely got to get to the bottom of this, and that's why we put it in the survey. And you know, sure enough, it's definitely one of the kind of cultural touchstones, as you say, that particularly among, because it's much more prevalent among the younger generation, that really plays into their views on the issue and the direction that it runs. As those who have seen it are you know significantly more likely to support the legality of abortion.
Yeah, it's fascinating too. And then on the other side, the other thing you mentioned, which was a picture of an ultrasound,
yep.
this is really fascinating and relevant to legal and political debates that are happening right now.
Right.
I mean, there are pro-life groups in states trying to lobby for regulations on abortion providers, demanding that they show ultrasound images
right.
to you know, two people coming in potentially for an abortion. And they do that precisely because they've intuited this fact that now we see that, you know, seeing pictures of an ultrasound does at least lessen a person's support for legal abortion
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the data
you know,
would suggest,
just,
that's right, that those strategies are, you know, based on something you can actually see in the data, that it actually does have an effect. In our question, just to sort of make it absolutely clear, You know, we asked also about whether you had recently seen. We didn't define recently, but we did say recently seen. You know, an image of an ultrasound of a fetus, and yeah, it's a significant, it's a modest effect, but a significant one. And as you said, in the, yeah. in the direction of yeah, lessening support for legal abortion.
So,
I was gonna say, if I could pitch one your way, I'd love to know what you made of the. Pro-choice and pro-life labels findings in the study.
Yeah, this is exactly what I wanted to get to next. So the study finds that, you know, very few people are really hardcore pro-lifers or pro-choicers, but there's this gigantic mushy middle where people identify as both.
Right.
You know, they're asked, do you identify as pro-life? Do you identify as pro-choice? And they say yes to both. It doesn't quite surprise me. I mean, I've definitely encountered this myself
mm-hmm.
when people talk to me, and what they'll say, and it can actually lean in both directions, right? It mostly leans in the pro-choice direction where they say,
right.
okay, I'm for legal abortion, and that's what the numbers support too, but I'm kind of against it. I would never have one, so I'm pro-life.
Yeah.
I would support someone in my life that, you know, and try to prevent them from having one. And, you know, that, but it can lean actually the other way too, at least theoretically, right? So someone could be overwhelmingly pro-life and want abortion banned in a sense, or work
yeah.
for it, but they want women to choose it. I mean, they want women
right.
not to feel like they are forced into this. They want women to choose life. I mean, that's. In a sense, that's like what a lot of pro-life billboards are about when they just say choose life.
Mm-hmm. Right. They've got both words there. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's obviously a coherent position, but it's interesting too that, you know, our politics don't, accommodate that position very well. Right. I mean, they don't accommodate the mushy middle very well. In a sense, unless you are pro-choice and you just say, well, choice, everyone has the choice and you can be privately pro-life. But, you know, the reason our parties are kind of polarized on this issue is one, because there are hardcore bands on each side, and the pro-life band is especially intense, and maybe we'll talk about that later. But also, we don't have European-style abortion laws where there's some restrictions or some serious restrictions. You have to get, you know, permission slips or get certain advice. You know, third trimesters are out. You know, we have Roe v. Wade, which opens up abortion, and it's been upheld in Casey and other cases to permit nearly every abortion. And then you have just a patchwork of state groups trying to get one or two restrictions passed in each state, maybe a parental notification or something. You know, but it seems like European abortion laws actually are more reflective mm-hmm. of American attitudes. They're in that mushy middle legally.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what I know what you mean about that the current case law in the U.S. allows abortions sort of nearly in all cases. I mean, that's certainly not how I read the abortion terrain in the country. I mean, there's certainly, you know, viability guidelines and all kinds of other, you know, other kinds of things that would restrict when it is and isn't available. We have, you know, the Hyde Amendment and other kinds of things that are in place about funding. Yeah, but I mean, I agree with your bigger point that certainly these labels don't do justice, you know, to the kind of rank and file Americans. And I really hope that, in fact, if there's, you know, one big contribution that the survey makes, it really is to kind of map this complexity in a way that's taken seriously, right? That by both sides in the debate. I mean, when you really do look, you know, in the report we actually put side by side, you know, these numbers. And so, like you said, on the one hand, if you sort of ask people, and I guess the thing that we did in the report was we, in the survey, was, you know, most political polls You know, they'll ask people about pro-life or pro-choice, but it's all in one question, and you have to pick one or the other, which describes you better,
right,
being pro-life,
right,
or pro-choice. And so it forces people on kind of one side or the other of a dichotomy. And we had heard, especially in our focus groups among millennials, that they're really rejecting these dichotomies, right? That they say, look, I'm both, or I'm pro-life, but I'm also pro-woman. They would, you know, use phrases like that that were really just exploding these categories. And so we decided to say, well, what would happen if we allowed Americans, rank-and-file Americans, to say independently of one another how well the term pro-life describes you or how well the pro-choice term describes you? And, you know, lo and behold, it turns out that, you know, in the general population, we've got like 2/3 of Americans who say that the term pro-life describes them somewhat or very well. And if that's all I said, right, that would give you one picture of the country. But if I then turn around and say, but guess what? 7 in 10 Americans say the term pro-choice describes them somewhat or very well. And when we did more analysis to kind of look underneath it, you know, we've got 4 in 10 who are saying both. That's how you get that kind of
right,
of overlap. And it's also true among the millennial generation. There's a slightly more kind of lean toward the pro-choice label, but you know, you still got 65% of millennials saying they pro-life describes them very well. 75% saying pro-choice describes them well. And it's, you know, when we look at religious groups, every religious group, with the exception of white evangelical Protestants, but every other religious group has solid majorities saying both, right? That both pro-choice and pro-life describes them well. White
right,
evangelical Protestants are the one group that kind of stands out, with 80% saying the term pro-life describes them well. But still, even among this group, which is some of the, you know, white evangelical Protestant Christians are really, you know, what are typically understood to be the most one of the most pro-life constituencies in the country, but still nearly half, 48% of white evangelical Christians say the term pro-choice describes them at least somewhat well. So that's a pretty interesting finding, I think, and one that I think is, you know, that I think policymakers and you know, public opinion or political leaders would do well to take seriously.
Right. You know, there's it's funny, it occasions a couple of thoughts. I mean, one, you know, you're saying people are exploding the normal categories. I don't know if anyone pro-life says, hey, I'm pro-life and I'm anti-woman.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
usually the anti-woman is kind of like trying to say, I'm pro-life, but I'm nice about it, right?
Right.
Or
even I'm anti-choice, right? I mean, they're not going to say I'm anti-choice.
Right, right. Now, as far as, you know, it's interesting, white evangelical Protestants, which, you know, we always talk about, this is something that I think public opinion surveys like this have, it's very difficult to parse these categories, and we always try with church attendance being one of the major measures. But, I mean, the white evangelical Protestants are a group that, when they self-identify as such, they Protestant churches are extremely affiliated by politics now.
Right.
I mean, conservative evangelicals tend to go to church with other conservative evangelicals. Mainline Protestants tend to be liberal and go to liberal churches. There are conservative parishes in mainline denominations that tend to be very conservative on a whole. So there's, you know, Protestantism allows for this kind of political affiliation and aggregation that, say, Catholicism doesn't anymore, at least in America, especially as you've had the breakdown of old ethnic neighborhood churches. And it actually explains why you see the only thing left in that distinguishes American Catholics on attitudes towards abortion is Hispanic
mm-hmm,
you know, non-white Hispanic. And because non-white Hispanics are grouped together in some churches where they have Spanish language priests, priests fluent in Spanish language. But it's interesting because Protestants have the ability to move to a different church based on that political affiliation or on a theological attitude, whereas, you know, Catholics don't have that. So,
yeah,
you know, there's no separate, like, we're the Orthodox Catholic Church and we are the modern Catholic Church. They're just kind of thrown in the middle there. And the only way to try to distinguish them is by church attendance.
Yeah. Right. No, I think that's right. Go ahead. Yeah.
It's not a perfect measure, right? I mean, I have family members who are very liberal Catholics and are daily communicants. They go to church every day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, it's taken as a shorthand for fervency, and it is in a lot of senses. But it's not necessarily church attendance. It correlates well, but it's not tied perfectly into kind of a conservative view
right.
of social issues or religion generally.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you bring up this point on, if I could jump in, on religious attendance. Because I mean, one of the things that I think happens a lot on public opinion surveys is really exactly what you're saying, that religious attendance gets taken to be the proxy of all things religious. And I've even seen in reports, conflating the term attendance with commitment, right, as if those two things are the same thing. And, clearly there's some correlation there, but they're definitely not the same thing. And one of the things we were able to do in this study, because it was so large, is actually look underneath attendance by religious affiliation and be able to see that, attendance matters, and it matters everywhere, but it matters differently in different religious traditions. And, as we've been saying, it matters most, the attendance effect is actually most pronounced among Catholics. Like the general population and their support. So, like, just a quick number, if you look at Catholics who attend Mass, weekly or more, and as you say, this is not a perfect, correlate, but only 34% of that group says that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. And that's about
stunning, I think. That's a stunning number.
Yeah, it's about 4 in 10 Catholics who attend at that level. And then about 3 in 10 Catholics attend, like, monthly or a few times a year, and the gap between those two groups is just huge. It's almost 30 points. So 34%, it's 62% who say abortion should be legal in all or most cases among the monthly attenders.
Yeah, it is massive. I mean, it's a funny thing too. I mean, it is like on Christmas and Easter, the Catholic Church suddenly becomes way more pro-choice than it is on Holy Thursday or something. It's also interesting, we talk about church attendance too. That's always reported church attendance, right?
Yeah, right.
So what we're doing also is we're measuring not exactly church attendance, but how often people want to say that they attend church.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's a truism, and there have been a number of studies that have kind of documented this, that, if Americans really attended church at the rates they report they attended church, I don't think there'd be enough pews for those behinds in the seats.
That's exactly right. But it's funny because, it always, I think the importance of religion is in American politics has been exaggerated by this number of church attendance thing. I mean, there's just, Americans habitually lie about this in a way that I'm not I haven't looked at European studies, but I'm not sure that they do as much in Europe. I mean, people always seem to over-report their attendance at church.
Yeah.
And in some ways that may be aspirational, and that does tell you something. So someone
right.
that goes to church once a month but says, I really should, I believe I should be going, every Sunday. I just don't always make it.
Yeah,
I think that's right. Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, it really is what's interesting about it is even though, like, we know that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between, and it's probably like a one-to-two correspondence, right? Probably overestimated by a factor of two. But nonetheless, what's interesting about it is these self-reported measures, even if they're not, accurate for the number of times people are actually showing up in church, they nonetheless show an effect, right, on voting, on a whole range of views. It really is one of the more consistent religious measures and reliable religious measures for parsing people, out.
Yeah.
And it is, but as you say, it really is about, it is aspirational, and it is about a kind of, I think what it also is a picture of the kind of religious person that they think they are, right, is part of what they're
right.
voting.
That's right.
Yeah, and you know, but that makes a difference. The kind of, you know, if they perceive themselves to be the kind of religious person that, you know, should and tries to go once a week or more, that puts them in, you know, one category. And they probably do attend more than the people who say, you know, I'm the kind of person who goes once or twice a month. And, you know, we see these big attitude divides. One other point on this, though, that's interesting is that, you know, we're talking about white evangelical Protestants and kind of their unique stance on abortion that, you know, I mentioned this big gap between the weekly or more Catholic, weekly or more attenders among Catholics and the monthly to a few times a year group, where, you know, majority of that monthly crowd among Catholics says abortion should be legal in all or most cases. That's not the case among white evangelical Protestants, right? If you look at that monthly, there's still a gap. It's about 20 points instead of 30 points. But, you know, among white evangelical Protestants, the group that goes weekly or more, only 23% say abortion should be legal in all or most cases. That number does jump, but it only jumps to 42%, well short of a majority among those monthly attenders. And, you know, a kind of interesting little side note here is that even in a survey this big, white evangelical reported church attendance is so high that we actually didn't even have enough people in the sample who said they seldom or never go among white evangelical Protestants. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And I guess on the other
side... It makes sense on that self-selection bias,
Right. But on the other side, what's also interesting is that among white mainline Protestants and black Protestants, the effective attendance is, you know, it's still there. But even among the most frequently attending folks in among white mainline and black Protestants, a majority say that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. So they start even in the most frequently attending category in majority territory, and then it goes up from there to the less attending categories. So I guess the bottom line is just saying that you're totally right to kind of point to, you know, attendance matters, but it matters in different ways for different groups.
It's interesting, you know, I wonder if there's a way to build on, you know, there was something in the study about how people rate their churches and how they deal with these issues.
Yep.
And I wonder if it would be interesting to find out or study, you know, these 4 in 10 Catholics who attend church weekly and, you know, only a minority support legal abortion in most or all circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, is it because they're going to church?
Yeah.
Is it because they are this issue is being explained to them in a way that they find persuasive and coherent in the church?
Right.
You know, so is the church having an effect there, or is it merely a kind of affiliation thing where they pick it up more passively, like, well, I'm the type of person that goes to church, I believe Jesus rose from the dead, I believe in the apostolic succession in the Catholic Church, and, you know, pretty much everyone who believes that in the way I do also believes abortion is disgusting.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the toughest things to sort out is, you know, we kind of have this mantra in kind of the social sciences that correlation is not causation.
Right.
And sorting out these causal vectors is really nearly impossible. But, you know, what we can do is say, you know, we can see the correlations. We can sort of test for kind of if there are intervening variables. But at the end of the day, it's really almost impossible to sort out because there's two possibilities here. One is that, you know, people are seeking out churches that correspond to views they already hold. Right. So they're going to get they're wanting to find a church that's going to if they consider themselves to be opposed to abortion and pro-life, they're going to be looking for a church. And in America, right, the kind of church shopping phenomena is pretty rampant.
Right.
And so they're going to be looking for a church that's going to echo those views. Or, you know, is it that they are sitting in a church and it's because they hear those views that their attitudes begin to kind of come more in line? It's really impossible to sort that out with the statistical data, but the correlations are pretty clear here that for the most part, people are in churches that kind of correspond with their views on the issues in the data that we see. One other little side note, it is interesting that they hear about these issues differently. So, for example, if you look at Catholics are much more likely to hear about abortion than they are about homosexuality. versus Protestants, right, who are about as likely to hear about either one. And that's a kind of interesting phenomenon, too, that, that you know, Catholics are hearing much, much more about the issue of abortion than Protestants are, and particularly if you compare it to how much they're hearing about homosexuality.
Right. I mean, it makes, I mean, I have all sorts of little pet theories as to why that is.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of them would probably horrify people to hear, but you know, abortion's been, there's been such a push in the Catholic Church on abortion for years, and there's all sorts of things in the theology. I mean, Catholics spend a lot more time contemplating even the pregnancy of the Virgin Mary and things like that, that, you know, might correlate to that conviction. And then also, you know, maybe I'm one of the few conservative Catholics that might say this, you know, there's just lots of homosexual men in the priesthood, which may also be a reason why it's just not talked about as much either. I mean, you know, Protestant churches are led most often by married men.
Right.
And so I wonder if that's that accounts for that. But I want, there's something in the report that I actually found utterly explosive.
In
explanatory power, which is that majorities of people that are pro-choice, majorities of people that are pro-life, however you slice it, they believe that being pro-choice is more socially acceptable.
Yeah, right.
I think this is the most dynamic thing in your report. I also think my personal theory is that pro-choicers should be dancing in the streets over this finding. In fact, I think it is their victory. I think they have won. I think this is game, set, and match for people who want to preserve legal abortion, this one number. And why don't you explain that a little bit in detail? And then I'll explain why I think it has this meaning.
No, I'd be great to hear a little bit more about that. But, you know, it is interesting, and, you know, especially if you put this into the context that we were talking about earlier about the complexity of these labels, right, that, you know, kind of majorities, strong majorities actually claim both the labels, pro-choice and pro-life. But yet when you ask, which one is more – and the way we asked about this is which one is more socially acceptable in contemporary society. That's the way we asked the question. We found a majority, not a huge majority, but 53% say it's more socially acceptable to be pro-choice in America today compared to 32% who said it's more socially acceptable to be pro-life, and the rest said they didn't know. But what's interesting about that is how consistent this finding is across the political spectrum, across the religious spectrum. So, for example, we have majorities of Democrats, majorities of Republicans, majorities of liberals, majorities of conservatives, all saying that pro-choice is more socially acceptable today. Catholics are a little more divided. 49% say that, but still lean more towards saying pro-choice is more, 49%, almost half, saying it's more acceptable to be pro-choice today, 39% saying it's more socially acceptable to be pro-life. And that difference actually is largely due to the divide we were talking about earlier, that is between white Catholics and Latino Catholics. Because Latino Catholics actually are the only group that sort of we saw in this initial analysis that we did, where a strong majority say that the pro-life label is more socially acceptable. Among Latino Catholics, 61% say that the pro-life label is more socially acceptable. But among virtually every other group we looked at, again, across the political spectrum, the ideological spectrum, it's majority saying, yeah, pro-choice. So tell me a little bit more about why you think it's such an explosive finding.
Okay, so I think that in one level, socially acceptable is a little vague in the one sense. So it could mean that, you know, socially acceptable to you. It could mean something like,
right,
in your social circles, what do you mean? But it also, most likely for most people, is a very clear way of saying which view is stigmatized in society and by the elite. I mean, pro-lifers are, and even somewhat hardcore ones, are a very sizable minority in the United States.
Right.
And so for them to tell pollsters or social scientists that their views are less socially acceptable, I think it explains two things. One, it explains the intensity of pro-lifers, which is documented elsewhere in this study.
Yeah.
Right? That they view this as a critical issue. And it's because if you... Most people do not believe anything that has a social cost to it, associated with it. At least I think. Or they're not vocal about their views when they have some kind of social cost. And I think that's what this measures, is a perceived social cost for these views.
Right.
And so, people who retain a belief despite social cost, even a trivial or marginal social cost, are much more likely to be intensely convicted about that that belief. They're much more likely to hold a strong view. And in fact, it will continue to intensify, I believe, until it's a vanishingly small minority. Because you're holding this view knowingly, knowing that it's a resistant view, or a view of that requires some kind of resistance to what you view as the dominant view.
Go ahead.
I just think it's so powerful. I think this is, it means that there's not, that it's harder for pro-lifers to gather and collect those people in the mushy middle for their views, because people will be like, well, this is like, I don't want people to know about my involvement in this. I don't know if I could get in trouble at work for it. I don't know if I could get trouble in my social clubs for it. I think it makes it just so much harder for the pro-life movement, you know, to cut against this. I mean, to me, it seems like this is the victory for the pro-choice side.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about this. Yeah. You know, what's interesting too is if you look at the poll, we did actually want to see, like, okay, if we only look at people who have very, very strong views about the legality of abortion, how does that affect what they think is the most socially acceptable thing? And so when we took a look at that, it turns out that it doesn't. So on the sort of among people who say that abortion should be legal in all cases, right? Those are kind of the people most out on the poll, on the kind of pro-choice poll, say that they're actually no more likely than the public to say that being pro-choice is more socially acceptable. They're right at 52%. On the other side, there is an effect, but it's still pretty muted. I mean, it kind of goes – it supports what you're saying. So if we look at the – on the other side, these are sort of people who are at the poll on sort of the illegal in all cases, right, that group. So Americans who say abortion should be illegal in all cases, they are more likely to say that being pro-life is more socially acceptable at 40, but it's only 43%, and they're basically divided. 43% say that being pro-life is more socially acceptable, and 45% saying pro-choice is more acceptable. So, I mean, it basically supports what you're saying, that it's interesting that this number is fairly stable, and even if we take the most kind of polarized – people who hold the most polarized position on the issue of legality, their views don't move that much on what's socially acceptable. But let me run this by you as one – sort of theory and tell me what you think about this. You know, because I think one complicating factor on this question may be that one of the things we know about, for example, white evangelical Christians is that kind of part of their story in America, and I can say this as someone who grew up evangelical in the South, I mean, part of the story of evangelicals in the country is a sort of sense of being outside the elite, right? A sense of having one's views not being accepted by the kind of mainstream culture. And there was a great sort of study by Religion News Ethics Weekly back in, I think, 2004 that had this great finding, you know, that had at the same time white evangelicals thought that it was really hard for their views to be – I think the way it went, it's hard for their views to be heard in mainstream culture. And at the same time, they felt part of mainstream culture, right? So this kind of – arriving but still not quite being accepted. I mean, and there's a long history, you know, out of the biblical tradition too of kind of a – it's a mark of fidelity, right, or a mark of religious faithfulness to be outside the mainstream, right? That's a kind of where if you're holding a kind of prophetic stance against mainstream culture, that's a, right. You know, in some ways a sign of being religiously faithful, that you're staking out territory, you know, and holding your ground and kind of being a moral, you know, witness, those kinds of things. And the only thing I wonder about that I don't know that we can't sort out from the data here is whether part of that is playing a role here, particularly on the numbers among those who are such strong supporters, such strong opponents of the legality of abortion, still saying that pro-choice is more acceptable because it's sort of built into the kind of cultural stance, the oppositional cultural stance.
Right. It could be that. Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it, or at least it helps people to perceive it when that's the case. I mean, it's just interesting because we don't know how people define or how people think social acceptability is defined.
Yeah, we did at least say in the question socially acceptable in contemporary society. So that's, you know, we didn't define exactly what that meant, mm-hmm. but we did have that referent to people.
Right, but I mean, it's interesting, like, what does that mean? But I mean, right. It's just funny to me because when I hear the word socially acceptable, that seems like such a baseline measure. It just seems like such a, you know, is it acceptable? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that sounds like it's on the edge of, if it's not socially acceptable, it means it's almost intolerable. Maybe people don't take it that seriously. Maybe they just mm-hmm. view it as which one has more status cachet along with it.
Uh-huh. Right.
That's my
right.
guess. I think that, though, is the hope for people who want to preserve the legality of abortion is just that it's viewed as a high-status cause. That means you're going to get high-status people attracted to it, celebrities, etc., and you know, the pro-life movement will be sweaty, white, easy to parody evangelical men or like dandruff-ridden Catholic priests. You know, maybe it's my low view of human nature, but people just want to join the winning side,
right?
So people see it as the winning side, and maybe this is a good point to transition to talking a little bit about, speaking of winning sides, a little bit more about the gay marriage part of this
sure.
survey.
Yeah.
And to me, just as stunning and dramatic as that finding, you know, maybe more, certainly more significant, is millennials have just a huge jump in positive associations with and approval of
right.
gay marriage. And in a weird way, I don't think people understand how quickly a gay marriage is going from being a marginal, barely known or barely existing cause to being the cause celeb of our culture.
Yeah.
I don't think people sufficiently appreciate the numbers. I can't think of a single social or political issue that's seen this much movement this quickly.
Yeah.
And why don't you talk about that? I mean, how, you know, in a generation, there's just been a tremendous move on this issue.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, just one case in point here, if we look at, you know, we rewind the clock back to, say, 1999, just to kind of get a look at these two issues.
Perfect, yeah.
You know, right. So if in 1999, you ask kind of how many people said that abortion should be legal in all or most circumstances, 57% said that. And when our survey was just out of the field in May, 56%. Right. So
yep.
Just no movement at all. I mean, these numbers are remarkably stable. And, you know, in any poll you want to look at that asks the question this way, this is basically what you get. If you go back to that same point in time on the issue of same-sex marriage, then the general public only in 1999, only 35% of the general public said that they supported same-sex marriage. In 2011, for the first time, I think there are now five public opinion polls, including one of ours. CNN, Washington Post, Gallup as well, all showing for the first time this year support in the general population moving into majority territory at 52 or 53% in the general population support for same-sex marriage, with that number being driven mostly by the younger generation, really. What's interesting also is where the breaks tend to be on that issue is that they break hard, you know, at 50 and older. Right? There's clearly the youngest generation is the most supportive. There's still pretty substantial support in let's say under 50, and then there's the support breaks off pretty quickly. So it's very, very clear generational divide on the issue. And what's really interesting about this is that the numbers have moved. I gave a 10-point span, but most of that movement really has been since 2009. Right, so it's really actually quite a short amount of time that we've seen. You know, in 2009, that number for support for same-sex marriage was only 40%. Right, so from 1999 to 2009, it moved 5 points. From 2009 to 2011, it moved 13.
Do you have any numbers? Do you have any pre-99 numbers, like going back to the early 90s?
You know, I don't write at the tip of my hand, right offhand, but it's basically, you know, you can look back in the General Social Survey and the National Election Study, two things that go back into the 70s. And these numbers are just low. I mean, it's just a, you know, it's a sort of slow, what you see basically back into the 80s is a kind of, you know, if you go 80s forward, a kind of slow, gradual uptick. That then just accelerates really quickly over the last couple of years. Go ahead.
It's interesting. I think I tend to think this issue is, it's not as instant as a pencil standing on its tip and then just getting a little bit of a push and then it just completely falls over to one side. But I think we're getting as close to that as we can with a major social change. And I literally think it's like, you know, there's an anti-gay marriage tank and a pro-gay marriage tank, and at some point the pressure between them changed, and all of the gas is moving from the anti-tank into the pro-tank mm-hmm. very quickly. I think it is going to be almost decisive in a very short time. And it's amazing. I wish people could even talk about the complexity within people's own lives, how quickly opinion has changed on this. We've been talking so much numbers. I'll talk another anecdote. Favor the audience with an anecdote. A member of my family, I remember very clearly, I was about 11 years old. A member of my family, I remember when Melissa Etheridge came out of the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And this person in my family is a very big fan of Melissa Etheridge. And she was shocked. She was totally surprised by it at the time. And I remember very clearly the conversation she was having, and she just said, you know, I just can't believe these songs, that these songs were written by another woman. I can't even comprehend it. I didn't think that, you know, maybe that gay people felt this way about one another. You know, I just... Now, fast forward 18 years later, I have a conversation with the same exact person, and I bring up what she said then, but I put it in the mouth of a third person. I pretend she didn't say it. I pretend I heard it from someone else. And she didn't recognize herself saying this, and she didn't believe it. It took a long time. Her reaction in 2008, I think it was that is such a backward attitude.
Huh.
I cannot believe someone would think that. And then it took me a long time to convince her, that is exactly what you said in 1993. I was 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
I clearly remember
yeah.
this.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting. I mean, and I feel like that is something that a lot of Americans are going through, where where gay marriage or homosexuality had a very peripheral existence in their mental framework at one point. The public debate has forced them to think about it, and then they just clearly jump on to a pro-gay marriage side, and the other side also becomes just almost unthinkable to them.
Mm-hmm.
That was just an amazing phenomenon, and I think these numbers kind of bear it out. I mean, obviously, people over 50 are still holding on,
mm-hmm.
But I bet as the if we track that millennial generation, and I am one of them. I mean, I'm 1982, graduated high school in 2000. I think you're going to find people, that group is not only going to show the highest, but a growing support for same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
And I think it's also going to be one of these things where the social acceptability plays a huge role, a driving role. And, yeah. And like we said at the very beginning, there's no victim, there's no, or any victim, you know, is very abstract. You know, marriage itself is under attack, or, you know, that's the rhetoric. And it's so, it has no purchase whatsoever, I find. I mean, there's just, and there's also the fact that even, you know, I'm a conservative Catholic, even the people I talk to who are against gay marriage, have extreme difficulty articulating why.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's personally, I don't think it's
or at least why as a civil affair, right? That
right. Why is a civil? Well, yeah, they can articulate just a statement of fact, like, oh, the church doesn't marry gay people,
right?
You know, so I don't believe in it. I believe in getting married in the church. You know, maybe that's, I'm oversimplifying it, but they can't. They have a much harder time articulating a case against civil marriage. And, of course, I think there is one, but it's just not – it's not at all bumper sticker friendly. And it is, to, I think, even to the people who hold that view, not obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And so the imagery, even the pageantry of the gay rights cause, I think, just has an enormous – advantage, and I think it's just going to. I think it's a chemical reaction. I think this change has happened. I think it is unstoppable. I mean, just reading the literature about gay marriage from 20 years ago on the liberal side to now, it's night and day what people thought the prospects were for this this kind of cause.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, too, that's pretty clear is that's also kind of an interesting artifact of the millennial generation is that they're very supportive of marriage, but when you offer them the opportunity to say, do you support marriage or do you support civil unions or do you support no legal recognition, people, kind of middle-aged people, are sort of more likely to select that civil unions option rather than marriage. Younger people... the number of people in the younger generation who are going to sort of say, you know, I'm for legality, but I'm only for civil unions, is thinning out. I mean, it's a small number compared to other generations. So it's sort of like a binary thing for them. It's either marriage or nothing. Whereas I think many in the middle generations, you know, are sort of torn between sort of marriage and civil unions. And in fact, they basically divide out fairly equally in the middle generations between support for marriage, support for civil unions, and support for no legal recognition at all. So that's a kind of interesting piece to the puzzle, too. But, you know, circling back, I think it really is about, you know, that two things I'd point to is knowing someone that younger people much more likely to say, not only do they know someone, but they have a close friend or family member who's gay or lesbian. And that turns out to be one of the most powerful predictors of people's views on whether they support same-sex marriage or not. But they're no more likely than their parents to say they know someone who's had an abortion. And so that's one factor. And I think the other factor is just these differential moral evaluations, you know, that that a majority of younger millennials say that, you know, that sex between two people of the same gender is morally acceptable, whereas they're conflicted about the moral acceptability of on abortion, basically evenly divided.
Right. It's interesting. You know, it's funny. We covered abortion a lot, but statistic about knowing someone who's had an abortion, I was very curious about that when I read it, because when you know someone who's had an abortion, I think when you're asked, should abortion be criminalized or should it be legal?
Yeah.
I think the most natural thought that crops up, especially in a young person's mind, is if I know someone, so say I know someone's name Stacy. Well, when the question comes, should abortion be criminalized, should it be legal, the thought comes, oh, should Stacy go to jail for what she did?
Mm-hmm.
And the answers, you know, that creates tremendous pressure to say, no, I don't think Stacy should go to jail for what she did. But, of course, that's not necessarily the reality of the situation, right? If abortion were criminalized, it changes the entire economy of sex, sex seems like a much more greater risk, and people would take very different decisions about whether to have sex, what kind of contraception to use, how quickly to start having sex, etc. I mean, you'd be creating the criminalization of abortion would create an entirely new set of calculations for people. And Stacy, you know, in that case, may never have wanted or had that abortion.
But that operates
in such a level of abstraction that I think that's very hard to tease out in when you're just answering a question.
Yeah.
You know, the question is just put to you.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, we were careful about how we asked the question. I mean, we were actually quite careful about, because I've seen polls that actually ask about, you know, putting women and doctors in jail and, you know, criminalizing abortion. They put it in fairly harsh terms. And when you do that, you can, of course, drive up the numbers. And we tried to put it fairly straightforward about whether it should be legal or not, whether it should be available in your local community or not. And just to note, in terms of question ordering too, you know, we waited till the very end of the survey to ask about whether they had knew someone who had an abortion or not, because we knew actually, you know, if we asked that at the very beginning of the survey, then every question they get after that is in the context of this very concrete experience that they had.
Right, exactly.
So we were pretty careful actually in terms of question ordering to not ask that question. We didn't ask that until we were at the very end of the survey.
Yeah, I was very curious about when it was asked. Because I do think it would have that effect. I still think it has an effect even before, you know, the bare fact of it, not even just when you ask it. Because, you know, in a lot of these questions, you're not saying, okay, engage in this thought experiment about
I'm not saying that people don't bring their, I mean, they absolutely do bring their concrete experiences to these questions, whether we've prompted them or not. I mean, I think you're
right.
Exactly,
I mean, we
right
all do.
That. Yeah, right, right.
There's an interesting thing. I guess the one criticism I had, I think this is a masterful bit of study. I think it's very well presented. I think anyone interested in these issues should take a long look at this this study.
It's funny, and
I even showed it to a friend who does a little bit more work in polling, and she thought it was great, too. The only thing that bothered me conceptually was these questions about what type of morality you describe yourself as having.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you have a principle-based or situationalist based morality. And it's mostly, I can understand it's a great way of dividing people, because people can't do typically describe themselves one way or the other, right? When you put the question to them. They're capable of picking one side or the other. But I don't think morality works in that kind of either or way. Like, you either believe in principles or you believe that it's determined by a situation. You know, it's both.
Yeah.
I mean, people right. believe in principles and then apply them situationally. I guess you could say, that a question like that reveals how people approach a moral question at the beginning of it, but I don't think it quite captures how you do it. I mean, you know, there's a whole, you know, tradition of moral thought casuistry, which you know, really talks about those case-by-case basis for judgment, but it always takes cues from you know, kind of unchanging principles.
Right.
That's exactly what explains why people, you know, maybe this explains why we found so overwhelmingly, or you found so overwhelmingly in this survey, that people are much more likely to support abortion in some cases when those some cases, have very little to do with their human agency, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When
mm-hmm.
when it's a rape, or when
physical health is in danger, yeah.
Health is in danger, yeah.
Yeah.
But when, even when a woman is poor, That's exactly when people start to, that's the question where people start to break off and say, no, you know, she should have the baby, or it should be criminal to have an abortion then. If I think it should be criminal at all, that starts to be where it begins. And I think it's because we just have such a strong, Americans tend to have such a strong sense of human agency and, mm-hmm. and how important that is.
Yeah, and there may be, yeah, a sense of, yeah, you know, that you can sort of make it work. You can, kind of American optimism that I think runs through some of these questions. I mean, you're right to point to that. I mean, the question you're talking about is a question we actually have that we replicated from the General Social Survey, which is a kind of long survey that's been running since 1972. Our findings are right on the nose with the last time they conducted it in 2010. But you're right. I mean, that's actually, you know, that what you see is much higher support for and the way this question reads, it really functions to say, if this is the main reason someone is giving, is this a reason where it should be possible or not possible to have a legal abortion? And you're right to say that there's much higher support for circumstances where, you know, it's beyond a woman's sort of control, that it's physical health, mental health, there's a chance of a serious defect in the fetus, those kinds of things are where you really see it. And when there are things like more circumstantial that are less solid, I think, than that, like the one you mentioned, that if she's poor, if she's still in high school, those things Americans are much more conflicted about, whether those...
Right. Well, there's a sense... I think there's a sense... I mean, I have a very, very negative view of human nature. So, you know, I think there's a sense...
You're a good Catholic, right?
Yeah, I guess. I think there's a sense, though, in which people want... this is such a negative way of looking at it. But I think people will look at someone when it was within their circumstances, right, to maybe prevent the pregnancy in the first place by either abstinence or better contraception. I feel like there's this vindictive streak in people, even in pro-life people, to say, like, okay, well, now you deserve to be punished with this baby. You know, now you deserve it. And you've got to, you know, frame positively would be, okay, you've done something and now you should take responsibility for it. Right.
Right. Right.
But I've always, I guess, thought that for the vast majority of people who don't really think about these issues, like, it's all, you know, these questions of abortion are about, like, your mood. Like, do I hate, you know, these sweaty, obnoxious religious people from the South more that are trying to get in my face about this stuff, or do I hate slutty young women more? And I guess I'm an irredeemable for thinking that way, but I do think that's the level on which people tend to engage on this. And it can change by mood, and it does change when you find out the circumstances of the girl, right?
Yeah, right.
So when the girl is, you know, in high school, people are saying, "Well, she should have known better. Her parents should have done better. So now they should have to deal with this."
Yeah, and I think they're weighing a whole, you know, thing. So well, you know, certainly that's going to be very difficult. But you know, are there other alternatives? They're starting to weigh in other factors, right? Where that in itself, and I think that's the way this question should be read. You know, is that does that in itself rise to the level of, you know, being the main reason for having an abortion? On that question, Americans are pretty evenly divided, you know, about whether it does. And on the other ones we're talking about, they're actually not. They're actually quite clear that, you know, if it's a serious chance of birth defect, if it's mental health, if it's a result of rape, if it's physical health, all those are in solid majority territory that, you know, that's an adequate reason where an abortion should be possible. But, yeah, these other ones, much more conflicted. And, you know, the one that where there's sort of the least amount of support is this, you know, one that's just if the woman's not married and just doesn't want to marry the man, like that in itself. And I think that says a lot about, you know, more acceptance of single motherhood and, you know, those kinds of things as well. That in itself for most Americans doesn't rise to the level of a sufficient reason.
Well, what exactly, I guess, you know, this is one thing that I was left wondering. I guess we have circled back to abortion, but one thing I was left wondering was, so millennials have attitudes very similar to their parents, but they have all of the they have all of the marks that correlate, or you know, they're less religious, more liberal on other issues.
Yep.
All the things that correlate with broader support for pro-choice views. So, you know, what is it that's holding it up at this level? I mean, because I guess we've always assumed, and we were trying to speculate earlier, you know, does church attendance actually help? You know, is that a cause of this? I mean, the study on its own would suggest it isn't.
Right. Not among them. I mean, yeah. No, you're right to point to this, and this is kind of maybe a good place to circle back to as we're kind of wrapping up. But this was actually one of the mysteries that brought us to this study in the first place, you know, is exactly what you're saying, that millennials, most of their profile would suggest that they would be more supportive of the legality of abortion than they are, you know, because they have all these other attributes. They're more likely to say they're liberal, they're more educated, they more likely to be Democrats. They're, you know, all these kind of things that you would think would push them in that direction. And yet, you know, they're not there. And, you know, what the study suggests is that, you know, a big part of this is about morality. I mean, we really do see that, you know, unlike the issue of same-sex marriage, where kind of more positive views of the morality of same-gender relationships, sexual relationships go hand in hand with higher support. I think one of the things sort of tethering the millennial generation to really be where their parents are is that they share their parents' moral kind of reservations on the issue of abortion. They haven't moved at the level of morality, and that in many ways has sort of tethered them and kept them from moving on the issue of legality as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think that sense of morality, it does cut across. You know, obviously it correlates with being reporting these pro-life views, but it also, you know, I see it just anecdotally among pro-choicers that there's still, you know, someone who has very developed views on abortion, one way or the other, but might view abortion as immoral, but have a political view that it should be legal, and that in fact it would be terrible if it were illegal, that it would have terrible consequences. So even that, and you know, maybe that explains where those people fall in, that view it as, you know, that pro-choicers tend to be rated as a lower issue than pro-lifers do.
Right.
But it's a fascinating survey. It certainly surprised me. I actually thought there would be more fall off for the pro-life view among millennials. Just not as dramatic as the fall off for, say, traditional marriage views or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's surprising, and it is going to change the politics going forward, I think. I think it still means that you know, I think in two election cycles, three election cycles from now, you know, a Republican presidential candidate will still have to, quote unquote, check the pro-life box. But, you know, in 15 or 20 years, I don't think that will be true at all on traditional marriage. And we're already starting to see it with John Huntsman showing support for civil unions. I think this is... I think that issue, the twinning of these issues, I think, is coming to an end quickly, and I think it confirms at least my view that this gay marriage issue is a freight train, and there is no stopping it at this point.
Yeah, no, so. I would agree. I mean, I think that if there's a, you know, end note on the future of, you know, politics, I mean, these things are moving fast. It won't be instantaneous, but I think you're exactly right that, you know, we may see because, you know, these in like the primary season, we may still see these issues kind of linked up together because there still is among conservative circles some coherence. But when we get to general election time and it's time to appeal to a broad middle of the spectrum, and, you know, as millennials kind of keep coming into their own, and every year, you know, these views are, I think, moving further apart. You know, we're going to really see the decoupling of these issues in a way that politicians particularly are going to have to navigate them differently. You know, we will pretty soon not be able to see, I think, the replay of the kind of, you know, 2004 quote-unquote values voter campaign, where you could just mention one or the other of these issues, and they almost stood in for one another. I think, you know, the days for that are, I think, are fairly numbered.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, anyway, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure, and congrats again on this amazing survey.
Oh, great. Well, thanks, Michael. Yeah, I appreciate you kind of discussing it with me. Thanks.
Sure. Take care. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks.